KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
The actual deal is a very conclusive one. We think just about everything's been approved. So good for both countries.
President Trump announced his first trade deal with the British Prime Minister on speakerphone in the Oval Office.
Today is Thursday, May 8th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. This hour, reaction from the Vatican and from Chicago on the selection of a new pope.
Also, parades and memorials in Europe marked 80 years since the end of World War II.
But there's a cloud hanging over the festivities.
We're seeing the rise of autocratic and authoritarian regimes once more.
Plus, glittering sapphire sea creatures are washing up on the California shoreline.
They're known as by the wind sailors.
They look like blue diamonds strewn across the beach, you know, is like these gems.
That's coming up after these headlines.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Speer. The first American pope was elected today by secret ballot inside the Sistine Chapel. NPR's Sarah Ventry reports from the Vatican. The crowd was shocked when Cardinal Robert Prevost became Pope Leo XIV.
The packed crowd of tens of thousands was audibly stunned when the identity of the new pope was revealed.
Cardinal Emma Prevost.
Max Gleason is a 21-year-old Catholic American college student studying in Italy who came with two of his friends to find out who the new pope would be.
I didn't know a whole lot about who was going to be the next pope. I didn't have a ton of guesses, but my one thought beforehand was like, it's just not going to be the American.
Yeah, the American pope, yeah.
But super excited.
The new pontiff appeared emotional during his first public appearance in his new position as the head of a church that serves 1.4 billion people worldwide. Sarah Ventry, NPR News at the Vatican.
Despite some signs of easing, it appears tensions between India and Pakistan remain extremely high after India's attack earlier this week that claimed the lives of at least 31 people who Pakistani officials say were civilians. India says its attack was in retaliation for an incident where a gunman killed 26 people, mostly Hindu tourists, in India-controlled Kashmir last month. Pakistani officials said today Indian drones killed two civilians and wounded four soldiers. Islamabad has said it shot down several drones. Ukraine's parliament has approved a critical minerals and natural resources deal with the U.S. that both sides are calling a win. NPR's Joanna Kakissa reports from Kyiv. Lawmakers there still want more clarity, though, and security guarantees for Ukraine.
The deal will allow the U.S. to develop and profit from Ukraine's critical minerals and natural resources, while also investing in the country's reconstruction. Ukrainian lawmaker Roman Kostenko, who is also a colonel in Ukraine's armed forces, said he remains concerned that the deal does not have explicit security guarantees. So this is an open question, he told NPR. Maybe these security guarantees are addressed elsewhere in separate technical agreements that we have not seen. Lawmakers added a paragraph saying that the deal would cover all Ukrainian territory, including Russian-occupied areas. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News. Cave.
It was unveiled this morning in grandiose terms by the Trump administration, billing it as the first major trade deal, but with a limited amount of actual detail. The agreement announced by the U.S. and U.K. would open up the British market to American beef, ethanol, and other agricultural products. In turn, it would give British-made cars and steel better access to U.S. markets. President Trump, speaking in the Oval Office this morning, said additional details are still being worked out. Stocks gained ground today after the U.S. and U.K. announced some details of the deal. The Dow up 254 points. This is NPR. In Washington, groups representing disabled and older people and their paid caregivers rallied to tell lawmakers don't cut Medicaid. House Republicans next week are expected to consider Medicaid cuts in order to help pay for President Trump's domestic agenda. Here's NPR's Joseph Shapiro.
At the base of the U.S. Capitol, the protesters staged a 24-hour vigil. They told their personal stories about how Medicaid pays for long-term care for their older parents and disabled children. Elena Hung runs a group called Little Lobbyists. She defended the insurance program for 72 million poor and disabled adults and children.
It is the reason why children like mine, children with complex medical needs and disabilities, are able to live at home instead of an institution or a hospital or facility or whatever you want to call it that's not home.
Some Republican lawmakers are balking at the prospect of slashing Medicaid to pay for the president's tax and spending cuts. Joseph Shapiro, NPR News.
Authorities say a Mississippi man who harassed Jennifer Aniston for 2 years, then crashed his vehicle through the front gate of her home, has now been charged with felony stalking and felony vandalism. The L.A. District Attorney announcing the charges today against 48-year-old Jimmy Wayne Carwile. Carwile was to be arraigned today on the charges. Prosecutors allege he also harassed the Friends actor through voicemail, email, and social media. Crude oil futures closed higher today. Oil up around 3% on some renewed hopes of a breakthrough on U.S.-China trade talks. Oil gained $1.84 a barrel to settle at $59.91 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington.
And I'm Scott Detrow in Rome on the edge of St. Peter's Square. Pope Leo XIV is the new head of the Roman Catholic Church, and Pope Leo XIV is from the United States of America.
Sancte Romanae Ecclesiae Cardinalem Prevost.
In the conclave's second day, the College of Cardinals elected Cardinal Robert Francis Prevost, a 69-year-old from Chicago, as the church's 267th pope.
Questa è la pace di Cristo risorto. Una pace.
NPR's Ruth Sherlock was in the crowd at St. Peter's Square when it happened. Ruth, what was it like?
If there's one thing the Catholic Church does well, it's these incredible spectacles of color and history. I was just standing there looking at St. Peter's Basilica, silhouetted against the fading evening light, swallows overhead, and all around me there were people engaging in prayer, like three ladies praying in their language from Bangladesh, Italian priests, everybody praying for the right choice of pope. Now, what that means is different to everybody. People from Bangladesh wanted somebody from Bangladesh. Others just wanted the right hope that the Holy Spirit had chosen, you know, made God's choice, if you like. And then suddenly, kind of almost out of nowhere, this billowing white smoke and everybody's waiting, singing, celebrations, bands in the crowd. And then as he emerges onto the balcony in St. Peter's Basilica and his name is said, in a way there was actually almost kind of a sort of confusion, because the speakers are not actually that good. People were asking themselves, sorry, who, what's going on? Everybody like desperate to understand. And then gradually you heard the name Prevost starting to come through the crowd.
This is the first American pope. We will have a lot more on his background throughout the rest of the show. But Ruth, with you, I'm wondering how people reacted to that news.
Well, you know, excitement and also some disappointment. We are in Italy, and it's been almost 50 years since an Italian pope, and Italians were among the front runners, so there was lots of actual anger around me. Some people seriously disappointed. But then I came across two American sisters in the crowd, Layla and Jenna Brown, and spoke with them.
I would never guess in a million years this would happen. I'm really, really happy.
Isn't that? It's so exciting. So you came all the way to Rome just for this?
Yes, yes, we came from Seattle. Yes, just for this, and it's first American pope. I'm so happy. I'm just so thrilled. I can't believe it. I can't believe it. Hopefully this brings Catholicism to America more.
Ruth, you've been talking to people for several days now. What are some of the themes you have been hearing from people in and around Rome in recent days?
You know, I think the thing that struck people about Pope Francis was this, a decision he made, or his personality perhaps it was, to try to kind of be with the people, to try to not let his extraordinary job kind of take him away from the more normal. So, for example, he was pretty scathing of some of the more ornate religious dress. He used to call that grandma's lace. Mm-hmm. And people like that. People like being able to connect with him on a human level. And I think that's something I heard again and again that people want from this next pope, somebody who is trying to reflect the needs of ordinary citizens all over the world, especially perhaps in nations where there is poverty and a lot of humanitarian suffering. Pope Francis, of course, was very outspoken, you know, looking at conflicts around the world, supporting people, speaking out against humanitarian suffering, for example, in the conflict in Gaza. And I think people were hoping that maybe that legacy is continued.
Ruth, I was stuck here in our broadcast space the whole time. I didn't get out in the middle of the crowd as much as you did. Who are the kinds of people who come into St. Peter's Square at this moment to see a new pope?
I mean, just incredible variety. It's amazing walking through the crowd because you hear languages from all over the world. It's such an international scene. And then you had people who had brought their small children, tiny babies. I've met somebody who had a baby who's just days old.
Wow.
You know, coming hoping that they would be blessed by the new pope. Also, a French woman in a shimmering gold sequin floor-length ball gown had come to celebrate this moment. A real variety, not just people in religious dress, priests, but also people from all over the world.
That is NPR's Ruth Sherlock, our Rome correspondent, who was in the crowd in St. Peter's Square at this big moment. Thank you so much, Ruth.
Thanks so much, Scott.
President Trump's sweeping tariffs have launched a global trade war and sparked economic uncertainty, but today he extended an olive branch to one trade partner, the United Kingdom. Here he is with British Prime Minister Keir Starmer on the phone, celebrating a preliminary deal he said would be the first of many.
The final details are being written up in the coming weeks. We'll have it all very conclusive, but the actual deal is a very conclusive one. We think just about everything's been approved. So good for both countries.
We are joined by NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith. Hi there.
Hi.
What are the specifics of the deal? What's in it for the U.S.?
President Trump said this would open up market access for U.S. agricultural goods to be sold in the U.K., including beef, and could lead to an increase in ethanol shipments. But there are still things to be worked out. For instance, the U.K. has different standards for beef than the U.S., and Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins is heading there soon to work on that. The administration suggested there could be a big sale of U.S.-made aircraft coming soon, too.
And what does the U.K. get?
Prime Minister Starmer said the deal removes steep U.S. tariffs on British steel and aluminum, and it lowers the tariffs for the vast majority of cars that are imported from the U.K. In fact, Starmer spoke to reporters today from a Jaguar Land Rover factory. But one thing that isn't changing is the 10% across-the-board tariff that President Trump announced last month. That is staying for most products.
So what's the larger significance here? Is this deal a sign of what's to come with other countries?
Well, the White House appears to be trying to build a sense of momentum for the negotiations that they are in right now with numerous other countries. They are 2 months away from a big deadline when the pause ends on the president's steepest tariffs, what he calls reciprocal tariffs. And you remember those big poster boards that he had listing all of the tariffs?
Mm-hmm.
Well, on that poster board, the UK started out with 10%. After the negotiations, it is ending up with 10%. But a lot of major trading partners were hit with double, triple, five times that much on their imports to the U.S. Trump indicated today that a 10% tariff is very likely the floor for everyone. He said the U.K. got a good deal because they got in the door early, suggesting others wouldn't be so lucky. And we have to say that the U.S. and U.K. came into these negotiations with a relatively balanced trade relationship. So this was arguably one of the easy ones.
Let's talk about one of the harder ones, China. There are trade talks scheduled this weekend in Geneva with top U.S. and Chinese officials. What do you expect to come out of that?
Yeah, the fact that there are conversations taking place at all is a significant shift from the total silence of the past month. Trump is currently imposing a 145% tariff on Chinese imports, which is functionally a trade embargo. China has also retaliated, and shipping has slowed way down. Products aren't coming into U.S. ports. So in the Oval Office today, Trump was asked about dock workers and truckers who are worried that they could lose their jobs. And he actually said that a slowdown is a good thing, not a bad thing, because no trade means no deficit with China. He also criticized the toymaker Mattel for saying it would have to raise prices on consumers because of the tariffs. Trump said he wants to put a 100% tariff on their toys so they won't be able to sell any toys in the United States. Mattel is an American company, but it does manufacture a lot of its products overseas.
That's NPR's Tamara Keith reporting from the White House. Thank you.
You're welcome.
California beaches have been the site of some ghastly scenes this year. Dying sea lions, dolphins, and even a minke whale have turned up on the sand. But lately, some beachgoers have been treated to a beautiful marine marvel. Hundreds of thousands of glittering sea creatures washed ashore. NPR's Vanessa Romo has more on what they are and why they are on the beach.
The small animals look like iridescent mini sailboats. They can grow up to 4 inches long, their oval base is gelatinous, and their colors can range from vibrant blues to shimmering purples. That's what left Emily Scher breathless when she saw tens of thousands of them on a sunset bike ride in Malibu a couple of weeks ago.
They look like blue diamonds strewn across the beach, you know, it's like these gems.
They're called Velella Velella, or by the wind sailors. They get their nickname from the semi-transparent, rigid sail that sticks up out of the water. Velella typically live on the surface of the open sea, but sometimes the wind sweeps them onto the shore in huge numbers.
I mean, they were everywhere. It was like a carpet. I've never seen so many.
Turns out, rafts of floating discs show up on the beach every year. On the West Coast, marine scientists say it's part of the spring transition, when the winds shift from north to south. Matthew Bracken is a professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of California, Irvine. He says velellas can't swim, so they're at the mercy of the elements.
They don't have enough propulsive ability to move against the prevailing winds or currents. And when the wind blows, it pushes them along, just like a sailboat.
Bracken says when you spot a velella, what you're seeing is not a single organism.
This is a large colony with a whole bunch of individuals, each specialized to a different purpose.
Velellas are related to jellyfish and Portuguese man-of-war, but they're not nearly as dangerous. Yes, they use their dangling tentacles to feast on prey, but the velella's stinging cells are harmless to humans, though they can be irritating. Bracken says that once they wash up, they don't survive long.
That blue fades and you're sort of left with these little whitish, semi-transparent skeleton remnants.
So, not nearly as pretty, but still a shimmering sign that summer's right around the corner. Vanessa Romo, NPR News.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations order and manage food for all their business needs. With online ordering from restaurants nationwide, employee meal programs, and tools to control food expenses, at easycater.com. This is NPR.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The Trump administration announced a sweeping plan to revamp the nation's air traffic control system today. This comes after more than a week of chaos and delays for passengers at Newark Liberty International Airport. NPR's Jacqueline Diaz was at the proposal's unveiling, and she's here in the studio now. Hi, Jacqueline.
Hi.
So what's in this new plan from the Transportation Department? What is the agency hoping to achieve?
Yeah, so basically the Transportation Department wants to replace the existing decades-old telecommunications, radio, and surveillance systems that air traffic controllers currently use. Right now, they rely on things that may surprise some people, like copper wires and floppy disks. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy wants to get rid of all of that in favor of the most modern technology.
The system we have here, it's not worth saving. I don't need to preserve any of this. It's too old.
But the plan could run in the tens of billions of dollars.
Seems like a huge undertaking that's got to involve airlines, politicians, unions, and others. How are other stakeholders reacting?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. There appears to be a lot of industry and union support for this project. CEOs from most of the major American airlines were at the announcement at DOT headquarters, and they all said this project is long overdue. Texas Senator Ted Cruz, who's the chairman of the Transportation Committee, said he'd lead the effort to get support from others in Congress. And Nick Calio, the president and CEO of Airlines for America, told me his group is part of talks that have already started with members of Congress. And he said lawmakers have been receptive. But on the other hand, he knows there's a risk for a fight over funding to become an issue.
It's partisan always, but when we get to the point of trying to fund this beyond what's there, it'll become bipartisan because everybody recognizes what has to be done.
You know, in the coverage of the chaos at Newark, experts have said a fix could take years. What's the timeline for this proposal?
Duffy wants to do this in under 4 years, but generally this will probably be a long road. Previous Government Accountability Office estimates have laid out around a 10 to 13 year timeline to properly update the technology, but Duffy seems really confident he can get it done within those 4 years. And I should add, we're still dealing with staffing shortages when it comes to air traffic controllers. Thousands still need to be hired, and this new plan announced today does not address that. Duffy announced plans for incentives and other programs to get more controllers on duty. But training those new controllers takes years. At the end of the day, there's a lot at stake here.
The fact is, an aging system poses an untenable risk to safety. I said it after DCA. I'm going to say it now. An untenable risk to safety.
That was National Transportation Safety Board Chairwoman Jennifer Homendy, and she was referencing the January mid-air collision between a commercial airliner and an Army helicopter. That crash killed 67 people.
It's NPR's Jacqueline Diaz. Thanks for your reporting.
Thank you.
Eighty years ago today, Britons gathered around their radios.
This is London. The Prime Minister, the Right Honorable Winston Churchill.
It was the British Prime Minister announcing
of unconditional surrender of all German land, sea, and air forces in Europe.
The end of World War II in Europe. It became known as Victory in Europe, or VE Day. On this 80th anniversary, there are memorials and moments of silence, but there's also fear for Europe's future security, with war in Ukraine and strained relations with the U.S. From London, NPR's Lauren Freyer reports.
The noonday toll of Big Ben's bells began 2 minutes of nationwide silence across Britain, broken by the fanfare of trumpets. As King Charles and his heir, Prince William, processed into Westminster Abbey with medals pinned to their chests for a Thanksgiving service next to elderly veterans in wheelchairs, including Harry Winter, aged 103. Winter was shot down over Germany, held as a prisoner of war, and then freed on the 8th of May, 1945. He told the BBC how it felt.
I just felt, I'm free. I can do what I like again. I can go around without anybody trying to hold me back.
1940s wartime ballads echoed through the soaring abbey. While outside, across Britain, there were tea parties in the streets. But in Germany...
In Germany, it's the exact opposite. It's very much a sort of somber atmosphere.
Katja Hoyer says 1945 was Germany's zero hour, when a new era started. May 8th is when Germans normally reflect on their progress since then. After the fall of the Berlin Wall and Germany's reunification, Hoyer says...
There was briefly a sense of jubilant optimism that now the Second World War and the Holocaust can just be seen as things of the past, when actually now we're seeing the rise of autocratic and authoritarian regimes once more, and the questions perhaps of the first half of the 20th century seem more relevant and immediate again.
Historians say the post-war global order is crumbling. And this celebration for VE Day today.
There's a lot to celebrate. I mean, my own father fought very bravely in the Second World War is a substitute for facing up to the very, you know, cold winds and storms we're facing at the moment.
Historian Timothy Garton Ash says those cold winds and storms represent the three big threats facing Europe: Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the rise of non-Western powers, including China, and the current American president.
The Putin shock, what I might call the Xi Jinping shock, and now the Donald Trump shock. And Europe is frankly reeling. And the question is, can we look after ourselves?
Across Britain, pubs will stay open 2 hours later tonight to allow people to raise glasses to the greatest generation. And then tomorrow, Russian President Vladimir Putin will host a huge parade on Moscow's Red Square. And China's Xi Jinping will be his guest. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
All Things Considered is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Like a story you heard on this or another NPR program? Share it with a friend at npr.org. While there, you can also hear stories you missed, enjoy expanded content, or connect to your favorite member station, wherever you are. Get the NPR app for your mobile device. You can also lean back and enjoy npr.org, optimized for the iPad. This is NPR.
This is NPR News.
Catholics celebrated in St. Peter's Square after just over 24 hours of secret deliberations. A conclave of cardinals has chosen the new leader of the Catholic Church. We will bring you the Pope's first speech and reactions from around the world tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Next, I'll ask Bill Gates why he decided to speed up the timeline for spending more than $200 billion of the Gates Foundation's money.
I've learned a lot in the last 25 years, including the incredible impact that these resources can have.
That's ahead. First news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. The Trump administration is proposing a multi-billion dollar overhaul to the nation's air traffic control system in the wake of recent deadly plane crashes and technical failures that have put a glaring spotlight on the outdated network. The announcement comes as Newark Liberty International Airport in New Jersey continues to deal with disruptions following a massive outage last week. Here's Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy.
If we don't actually accomplish the mission that we're announcing today, you will see Newark's, not just in Newark, you'll see Newark's in other parts of the country because it's an aging system. And so we have to actually upgrade it.
Duffy says the plan calls for six new air traffic control centers along with tech and communications upgrades at all of the nation's air traffic facilities over the next 3 years. In Manhattan today, jurors heard from the second of three women expected to make accusations against Harvey Weinstein. Ilya Marritz has more from the former film producer's retrial in New York.
Kaya Sokola told the court that in 2002 she was a 16-year-old model visiting the United States for the first time. She said it was during that trip that Weinstein sexually assaulted her in a Manhattan apartment. When she resisted, he told her she needed to work on her stubbornness. She said Weinstein assaulted her a second time, almost 4 years later, in a hotel room, saying afterwards, "You see, that wasn't so difficult." Sokola was not a witness at Weinstein's 2020 New York trial. His conviction was overturned by an appeals court on procedural grounds last year. Weinstein maintains his innocence. For NPR News, I'm Ilya Marritz in New York.
Well, stocks finished higher on Wall Street after President Trump announced the framework for a trade deal with the UK, the first since his sweeping tariffs went into effect. The Dow gained 254 points, up about 0.6%. Tech-heavy NASDAQ up more than 1%. This is NPR. State lawmakers in Maine are under pressure from the White House to ban transgender athletes from girls' and women's sports. Legislators heard from the public today as Maddie Smith of Maine Public Radio reports.
Republicans in the Democratic-controlled legislature are seeking the ban. Most of the bills take aim at the Maine Human Rights Act and gender identity protections that have existed for years but have recently garnered national attention. GOP lawmakers say those protections are unfair to female athletes and violate the spirit of Title IX, a 1972 law meant to expand opportunities for women. Most Democrats argue the ban would further harm the already vulnerable transgender community. Maine's Governor Janet Mills clashed with President Trump over the topic during a meeting of governors at the White House. Maine is now the focus of a lawsuit by the Trump administration, which is attempting to pull Maine's $250 million in federal education funding. For NPR News, I'm Maddie Smith in Portland, Maine.
On Capitol Hill, Senate Democrats block legislation to regulate a form of cryptocurrency, raising concerns about President Trump's extensive and growing portfolio of crypto ventures. The bill would regulate how stablecoin issuers operate here in the U.S. Democrats say the legislation needs stronger protections, while Republicans push back on demands to bar Trump and members of his cabinet from profiting off crypto while still in office. I'm Dwayne Brown. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Bill Gates marked the 25th anniversary of the Gates Foundation by announcing its final chapter. Over the next 20 years, the foundation will spend down more than $200 billion, all the accumulated wealth of the man who was once the richest person in the world. Gates says the goal is to save and improve as many lives as possible in that time, to, quote, end preventable deaths of moms and babies and lift millions out of poverty. Bill Gates is with us now to talk about his change of plans. Welcome back to All Things Considered.
Thank you.
I want to begin by disclosing that the Gates Foundation is a supporter of NPR. When you started the foundation, the intention was to sunset it several decades after your death. So what made you change your mind and set this much tighter deadline?
Well, I've learned a lot in the last 25 years, including the incredible impact that these resources can have. And so, you know, I know there'll be lots of rich people in the future, and the needs are very urgent today. I, you know, want to spend at an even higher level than we are right now because I see the pipeline of innovations. Some are, you know, pretty straightforward, like vitamins for pregnant women, or things that are complicated, like AI health delivery or gene editing to cure HIV. So with that in mind, you know, I'd like to make sure we do as much as we can in these 20 years. And I built a strong organization. Hopefully I'll be able to help guide it during all of those 20 years. But if not, it's got a strong culture and I'm sure it'll do well.
The amount of money we're talking about can be hard to imagine. So can you give us an example of what specifically you'll be able to do in the next couple decades with $200 billion plus dollars that you would not have been able to do with the mere tens of billions of dollars that you had been planning to spend over that next 20 years?
Well, one of the areas we work in is agriculture. It's, you know, health is by far our biggest, about 70%, and then education is about 15%. But agriculture, some people are surprised that we can do incredible things to improve seeds and educate farmers so that even in Africa, where today the productivity is the lowest and they face climate change and population growth, we want to get kids even more nutrition despite all of that. So we do better seeds, better chickens, better cows. And that's an area we're growing our spending a lot. This idea of curing HIV, you know, curing sickle cell, a few kids have been cured of sickle cell, but it costs millions of dollars for each case. And we want to do that for less than $100. So It's very advanced science, and it'll take us, even spending full speed, maybe 8 to 10 years to get that done. But I'm able to say to those scientists who are incredible, please go full speed ahead.
You've mentioned some ambitious goals like curing HIV, but less ambitious goals like treating HIV have seen dramatic cuts since the Trump administration has ended many of its foreign aid programs like USAID. So does your announcement have anything to do with the government pulling back on foreign aid spending? Are you trying to fill that gap?
No, my decision came after thinking about this for several years, and it's really timed with the year I turned 70 and our 25th anniversary. And so it's kind of strange that here we are in the middle of a global health emergency where the U.S. made gigantic abrupt cuts, and some of the European countries are also making cuts because of the demands to raise their defense spending. And so, you know, I can't overstate how awful it is to be in a period where the number of children who die is going to go back up. You know, it went down from 10 million to 5 million. We cut it in half.
Since the year 2000, right?
Since the year 2000, exactly. And it was supposed to keep going down. But with these cuts, millions will die. So I'm going to try and make the case that a lot of this money should be restored. There's a lot of benefits that have come from this less than 1% of the U.S. budget.
On vaccines specifically, a lot of your work has been about getting these life-saving vaccines into developing countries. And the last time you were on this program back in February, you told my co-host Scott Detrow that you were hoping to meet with Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who has questioned the science around vaccine safety and effectiveness. You said you were optimistic and hopeful about finding common ground. Have you been able to meet? Were you able to find common ground?
No, I'm still hoping to get that meeting. You know, since then, there have been some headcount cuts, so I'm worried. You know, the U.S. medical research has been hugely beneficial to the world. So, you know, I think the U.S. commitment to medical research is great. We got to make sure it continues, and we'll try and influence it in the right direction.
You recently told the New York Times, the world's richest man has been involved in the deaths of the world's poorest children. That's a reference to Elon Musk leading the effort to defund USAID. Have you spoken with him about that?
No, although he's a genius and, you know, expert in a lot of things. You know, I've been out and met these people. I've been to Nigeria and seen their great work. I've been to the Democratic Republic of Congo. And so this is one where I think he made a mistake.
What responsibility do you believe comes with enormous wealth?
Well, trying to avoid killing children, maybe. I've been involved in what's called the Giving Pledge that Warren Buffett and Melinda and I created to get philanthropists to share their thoughts, to encourage better giving, more giving. And, you know, philanthropy is on the increase, not just in the United States. You know, I'm trying to set an example by giving 98% of the money I have. Warren Buffett's been an inspiration to me. He, even before I met him, he'd written an article about how, you know, giving too much money to your children isn't necessarily good for them or society as well.
You're a notorious optimist. And sometimes when people who listen to the news every day ask me about the state of the world, I say, well, there's, you know, the Bill Gates view, which is that more people have access to clean water and education and fewer children are dying and more people, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You've in this very conversation said millions more children are going to die in the coming years than otherwise would have. And so how do the cuts of the last few months shape your outlook on the state of the world?
Yeah, I think the tragedy that this is so far away means that people don't feel it. And, you know, I think the basic religious principle of treating other people well is still applies. So you're going to see me speaking out a lot about these budget things. But no, I'm not pessimistic because I think the case is so strong that we can get the money back and then take advantage of pipeline of innovation, including a lot driven by advances in AI.
Microsoft founder and global health philanthropist Bill Gates, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. President Trump has said that tariffs could raise prices of some items, causing short-term pain. Some economists warn his budget proposal, unveiled last week, also carries long-term risks. NPR's Jeff Brumfield reports on the big economic consequences of Trump's cuts to fundamental research.
Casey Dreyer works for the Planetary Society, a nonprofit that advocates for space exploration. When he saw President Trump's budget proposal for NASA, he could not believe the numbers.
This is the worst NASA budget I've seen in my lifetime.
The budget has deep cuts for NASA's Science Mission Directorate, which oversees everything from telescopes peering deep into space to robotic probes exploring planets like Mars. Many of these projects cost billions of dollars to build and launch, but the budget cuts are so deep
that it will require NASA to turn off active spacecraft that are producing good science for pennies on the dollar for what the U.S. taxpayer paid for them.
It's not just spacecraft. This budget would switch off huge swaths of America's scientific enterprise. The National Science Foundation would be slashed in half. The National Institutes of Health would lose $17 billion in funding. Other agencies like the Department of Energy, the U.S. Geological Survey, and NOAA would all see deep cuts totaling billions. This would be bad for U.S. science, but it could also have a huge effect on the economy in the years ahead. That's because fundamental science underpins America's economic growth, according to Andrew Fieldhouse.
In dollar terms, the economic returns are really, really high.
Fieldhouse is an economist at Texas A&M University who studies how R&D impacts growth. He says since World War II,
government R&D investments are pretty consistently driving about 20 to 25% of all U.S. private sector productivity growth.
Consider NSF grant 8107494. It was given to a scientist named J.J. Hopfield in 1981. The grant was worth just under $300,000 back then, shy of $1 million in today's money, and it funded Hopfield's work into an obscure topic, artificial neural networks. That science now underpins the multi-billion dollar AI revolution powering the tech economy. It also won Hopfield a Nobel Prize in physics last year. Could the private sector have done the same thing? Richard Stern thinks so. He directs economic and budget policy at the Conservative Heritage Foundation. He says industry should be funding most of the basic research in America.
I think getting the federal money out of this, letting these labs have to actually sing for their supper and get money from private entities that actually want to research things that are practical to people, I think is the better way to stimulate growth by far.
But many other economists say industry can never replace government for funding basic research. Vasudeva Ramaswamy is an economist at American University.
Very often, the private sector ends up underinvesting in these fundamental basic research areas.
The knowledge generated is too general and the economic payoff too distant. Ramaswamy recently projected that America's future GDP could be more than 4% smaller as a result of these cuts. That's roughly the same size as the Great Recession of 2008, and that in turn will cost the government money.
The economy tomorrow is going to be smaller because you decided to cut that funding today. And if your economy tomorrow is smaller, you're going to be raising less in taxes.
The president's proposed cuts are just that. It's Congress that actually sets the budget. But if lawmakers choose to follow Trump's budget outline, Ramaswamy warns it could cost America its economic leadership. Jeff Brumfiel, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The new leader of the Catholic Church, Pope Leo XIV, was born and raised in the Chicago area. Devout Catholic family. Throughout the city today, Chicago Catholics were overjoyed at the news. I want to bring in Lauren Fitzpatrick from the Chicago Sun-Times and member station WBEZ to tell us more. Hi, Lauren.
Hi.
Hey, so a pope from Chicago. Tell us more about his roots in the city.
He was born Robert Francis Prevost at a hospital on Chicago's Near South Side. He's the youngest of three boys in a very Catholic family. His dad was a World War II vet and became an educator, and his mother worked as a librarian. The family lived in a little brick house in a bordering suburb called Dalton, and they bought this house brand new in 1949 with a $42 monthly mortgage.
Wow.
Yeah, the family was known to be very dedicated members of an old parish called St. Mary of the Assumption that sits at Chicago's far south end. And folks describe this parish as just the center of everyone's life in the neighborhood. You know, please picture blocks of dozens of children playing in uniforms, walking to school, into town. The mom, Millie, was known to be one of those church ladies who just keep a parish humming.
That's such an interesting portrait of a community in which he grew up. So I'm thinking, Lauren, today of that huge reaction we watched today at the Vatican. The new pope stepped out on the balcony, greeted the crowd in Italian and Spanish. There was applause there in Vatican City. What was the reaction in Chicago at a hometown boy being named pope?
Oh, in Chicago, it was joy, optimism, immense, immense pride. Chicago's Mayor Brandon Johnson, who I will note is not a Catholic, said, quote, everything's dope, including the Pope, comes from Chicago.
My siblings, we were all like, oh my God, that's amazing. It really is amazing. I'm really proud. And yeah, that's so cool. Just like one of us.
So that's Noel Neese, who was one of Pope Leo's grade school classmates down at the old St. Mary school.
Mm.
I got to speak to another classmate who was in the same class as the Pope, and he said when the Pope was a boy, he was known, like, he was just so smart. He always sat in the number one seat and was known to be really kind and compassionate.
And you told us a little bit about his home, that $42 mortgage. Tell me more about the church, the institutions that would have been part of his upbringing, because the Catholic Church in the South Suburbs, that has changed from how things look today.
The sad part is that all these places that today could be centers of celebration are just all gone. They've closed. The area back then was really full of Catholic families, and they had lots of kids. And in the meantime, you know, Dalton's Catholics both moved farther out into the burbs, and now everybody just has fewer children. So the St. Mary of the Assumption Parish got consolidated and then ultimately closed. Mendel Catholic High School, where his mom worked and where his brothers went, became a public high school. The Augustinian College in the South Suburbs, where a young Father Prevost lived for a time, that closed. I mean, it's hardly unique to Chicago, this trend. St. Augustine Seminary High School in Michigan is also gone.
That is Lauren Fitzpatrick with the Chicago Sun-Times, giving us a little bit of the background in that city of the new pope. Lauren Fitzpatrick, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
In two dozen states, citizens are allowed to propose ballot measures. Supporters say it's one way voters can address issues that their lawmakers won't. But Republican lawmakers in many of those states are now adding hurdles to the process, saying they want to fight fraud. NPR's Ashley Lopez reports.
Mark Johnson, a Republican state senator in Arkansas, says he was attending a festival last year when he came across some folks gathering signatures for a proposed measure that would protect abortion rights in the state.
They said this was about women's health. And I said, oh, really? Yeah. Well, they didn't make clear what it was.
This measure was ultimately blocked by the state Supreme Court, but Johnson and other lawmakers in the state's Republican-led legislature passed new rules that required the ballot measure's title to be read in full and out loud. The voter also has to show photo ID, and if any rules aren't followed, the person collecting signatures could be charged with a crime.
This is one of the biggest, the most egregious laws that they passed.
That's Bonnie Miller, president of the League of Women Voters of Arkansas. Her group is suing state election officials over this law, which they argue is unconstitutional. Miller says it's hard to imagine petition signers who are willing to stand around for all this, which she estimates could take up to 10 minutes per signature.
So it's really a problem in terms of time, ability to recruit folks to be canvassers, getting folks to sign petitions, getting as many people as you can to sign.
Miller says she thinks Republicans are afraid that an effort to put a pro-abortion rights measure on the ballot could come back since advocates got so close the last time. But Mark Johnson says this is not about preventing voters from getting measures on the ballot.
We don't want to take away their rights, but we want to protect them from special interests that will abuse the process and confuse them.
Opponents of these kinds of laws say they're seeing more of them this year than ever before. Kelly Hall is the executive director of the Fairness Project, which works to pass economic and social justice policies through ballot measures.
This is an absolute high watermark for the number of attacks on citizen-initiated ballot measures that we've ever seen.
Hall says some states are creating new restrictions for groups who gather signatures. Others are trying to increase the threshold a measure needs to pass. Florida is one state with a 60% threshold. Last year, 57% of Florida voters backed a measure protecting abortions in the state. But it didn't pass because of that high threshold. Here's Letitia Harmon with a social justice advocacy group called Florida Rising.
It's already really difficult to even get a measure on the ballot, and then it's difficult to pass it once it's on the ballot. And yet they have made a tax on ballot initiative. The governor has made a tax on ballot initiative one of his highest policy priorities.
Last week, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis signed legislation that limits how many signatures someone can collect and requires voters to show ID before signing a petition. Florida Republican State Senator Jennifer Bradley said during debate on the bill that its purpose is to combat fraud.
This is not a bill to restrict. It is a bill to protect, to make sure that our constitutional system is one of integrity and that it's free of fraud.
But opponents like Letitia Harmon said many of the claims of fraud that state leaders have pointed to are typical human error that now will be criminally penalized. Kelly Hall with the Fairness Project says she sees these laws as a broader failing of the relationship between representatives and their voters.
Direct democracy should be an opportunity for voters to say to their politicians, this is really what we want. You should listen to us.
Hall says instead, politicians across the country are making it harder for voters to affect change, that lawmakers lack the political will to address themselves. Ashley Lopez, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Mathnasium. Whether students are ahead of the curve or need extra support, Mathnasium's goal is to build confidence through personalized math instruction. Learn more at mathnasium.com. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its Sponsor Jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From BritBox, committed to shaking up people's watch list with British TV, including new original series like Ludwig, starring Peep Show's David Mitchell. Streaming now at BritBox.com/NPR. And from the William T. Grant Foundation.